This podcast may contain explicit language. Welcome to the Greatest Movie of All Time podcast, the show that uses a unique grading style to redefine what the greatest movies are. I'm Tom Duncan.
And I'm Dana Duncan.
Tonight, for a break from our regular programming, we've decided to bring you another of our list episodes, this time as we rank our personal picks for the best 15 films of the 1970s. Dad, before we get to each of our lists, let's start with some honorable mentions. Are there any films that didn't make your list that you would like to highlight?
Yes, I have several. Number one, this will be a little bit of a surprise, Heaven Can Wait. It is a film that was a comedy written in part by Buck Henry, was starring Warren Beatty, Julia Christie. I remember when it came out, I didn't see it in theaters because it was rated R, if I remember correctly. But I did see it on HBO when HBO was in its foundling state. Always enjoyed the film. Haven't seen it in a number of years. I would love to do it again or do it on the show. Are we going to go back and forth, or do you want me to give a couple more?
Well, I mean, I can read off a few entries from our guest-submitted list. We also have one submitted list for his top 15 and some honorable mentions from Mr. Andrew Corns of the Revisionist Almanac. So, first off, he would like to say he could sit there and write down another 100 movies from the 1970s, and he was frankly a little peeved at me that I limited him to only 15, that are particularly meaningful to him. But he isn't going to bore us with that. He'll just throw out some of the other films and directors out there who were on his short list as he compiled this list for us. While several 70s horror films feature on his list, I guess I'll read this in the first person. While several 70s horror films feature on my list, this decade was a revolution for that genre, including but not limited to Carrie, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Don't Look Now, Dawn of the Dead, and more. And I will say that he has at least a couple of horror films that will make appearances on his top 15, so we'll save a little for that. As far as my top honorable mention, I'm going to count backwards from five. I know you started with your number one, but I'm going to go The French Connection, the Best Picture winner of 1970, gritty crime drama with some interesting use of what is now the shaky cam, but was really kind of a guerrilla filmmaking style, revolutionary for the time in which it was made. William Friedkin, who won Best Director for that particular movie, just recently passed away, starring, I guess, for me, a top 10 actor that I've always enjoyed watching, Gene Hackman, for his only Best Actor Oscar-winning performance. He did win Supporting Actor for Unforgiven.
One of my very favorite films, The Sting.
Is in your honorable mention?
Yes, it's in my honorable mention.
Wow.
I could not.
I have this rated over you. Interesting.
I could not get it up into the top 15.
Okay.
It's number 16 on my list, actually. But another one that's on my list is, again, Young Frankenstein. That's 17 on my list.
So this is my number two honorable mention as well. And I know that Mr. Corns as well had a blurb about that on his honorable mention, so I will read that here. Comedy was booming, and while none of them made my top 10, I couldn't overlook the influence of Mel Brooks, the Monty Python crew, and Steve Martin's The Jerk, to name a few.
I forgot about The Jerk.
Yep.
I also have another one of my favorite movies of all time, Patton.
That's in your honorable mention. Interesting. Yes. I thought for sure that would have gone a little bit higher.
No, I we're rating the best movies, not our favorite movies, correct?
Yes.
Okay, my favorite movies are not necessarily the best movies. And then I have one more that I want to mention, which is a film I've tried to get you to watch.
Being There?
Being There. I saw it on HBO, and then I saw it again in college when they did it on movie night on Friday in the big science lab or the science lecture hall at Beloit College. Just love the film.
So a little bit more from Mr. Corns' list here. Leaving off Richard Donner's 1978 Superman brought me great anguish. It's one of my favorite superhero films to this day and signaled to the studios that this seemingly niche material could be made for the masses. As far as me and my next one up, I had number 4, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which may be controversial because I know it appears on at least one other list much, much higher. But for 1975, and I know we're going to be covering all of the Best Picture nominees that particular year next season, including this one. This one, to me, just has never struck a chord as to why it's rated as one of the greatest films of all time. In fact, compared to several of the common nominees, I'm not sure that I would have this still winning the Oscar that year. I mention it here solely for the crowd that thinks this is a part of the top 15 of the best. But even though it has great performances all over the place in most of its acting, I just don't know if it's necessarily one of the best 15 films from a decade that's just very stacked. All right, back to Mr. Corns here, since you've read off your 5. The 1970s was also the era of the directors. Terrence Malick gave us Badlands and Days of Heaven. Andrei Tarkovsky was changing the form in Europe with Stalker, Solaris, Mirror, etc. David Lynch showed people his twisted new voice with Eraserhead. Robert Altman delivered The Long Goodbye, MASH, Nashville, etc. And Ingmar Bergman, David Cronenberg, Hal Ashby, and the list goes on and on. So, that takes care of all of his honorable mentions, and all of these are available on the website. So if you want to view any of our honorable mentions or our top 15 as we kind of go through them, those will be there. Number 3 for me, I have Kramer versus Kramer. I know that this is a somewhat famous film, because it was a Best Picture winner. It was the number one film in a particular year. And outside of the just sheer amazing accomplishment that a family drama about divorce was the number one film of the entire year, when we're subject to kids movies like Super Mario Brothers and heavy IP movies like Barbie being the number one films in a particular year, this speaks of a completely different time that we were living through in the 1970s. But I think it's an underrated Best Picture winner. I think it's an often forgotten about Best Picture winner. I think that Dustin Hoffman might have given his best performance of his career in this movie. And I know that's saying something when he has The Graduate and Tootsie and several other great appearances to aid, including a film that's going to be higher on my list from the 1970s. But all in all, I think it's a fantastic film. Meryl Streep is, of course, great in the film, but the camaraderie between Dustin Hoffman and the boy in that one are just outstanding to me. And my number one honorable mention is my favorite Monty Python movie, which we'll be covering in little less than 2 months, and that would be Life of Brian. So I'm going to save some of my thoughts for that one, but given how The Passion of the Christ went for us recently, I think people might know where I come down on Life of Brian.
Okay. So Kramer versus Kramer was a good one. I had it on my list and did not get to put it on honorable mention because I just had other films that I ranked higher. And I actually saw Kramer versus Kramer its opening weekend in the theater.
Interesting. Okay. All right. So with that, shall we start with our number 15s? What do you think the order should be here?
Oh, we'll go back and forth. I would say you can give your 14 or 15th and 14th, and then I will give my 4 or 15th and 14th, and then we'll do Corns, and then we'll just kind of then I'll go first, then
we'll,
back and
we'll
forth.
We'll just do one at a time. We don't need to do multiples at a time. But we can go in me, then you, then Mr. Corns.
Okay.
And I should just preface this a little bit. If one of your favorite 1970s films does not appear on our list, I also put up on the website a list of about 50 films that I know are notable that I just simply have not seen. Included on that list would be The Omen, Coming Home, The Exorcist, Halloween, The Conversation, The Jerk, Serpico, Marathon Man.
I've seen all of these.
Days of Heaven, Harlan County, USA. I mean, no, there are a lot of films that are included on that 50 film list that are all very classics, but I have not personally seen. So if I didn't include one in there, you could just chalk it up to I haven't seen it yet. And maybe if we did a revisit of this list at some point in time, I may have seen more of those films. All right. So my number 15, this one might be a little controversial, but it's not only a favorite of mine. I think it is a very influential film. And I think it might be among Clint Eastwood's best. I have Dirty Harry from 1971.
Interesting. Okay.
I know. A lot of people would say it's kind of schlocky. It's kind of half acted. I think that this is a fairly important crime drama that aids to a expanding genre of the anti-hero. And yes, clearly leads forward to some of the other great crime dramas that we've had throughout time after this movie. So I have this as my starter.
Okay. And if we have it on our list, do we mention that right away or do we wait until we get to that?
What I should do is say that if we have it higher on our list, we should stop the other one and we can discuss it at that point. I would assume you have it higher and I kind of said something already, but probably shouldn't have.
That's fine. Yes, I have it as 14 because I think it is a phenomenal piece of film. It spoke to a frustration that was existing in the early 70s in the country as far as crime and how things were perceived. Things seemed to be out of control. And I think it spoke to America in certain ways. And I think Clint Eastwood was perfect in the role.
Agreed. What is your 15 then?
I have The Deer Hunter.
Okay.
Great film, great acting. The only reason it's down on my list is that I personally have problems with the subject matter and the concept of Russian roulette. It just kind of bothers me. So, but it was a very influential film, very important, and did, again, speak to a whole generation of people coming to terms with the Vietnam War.
It did not make either of the other of us on our list. So that's your number 15.
Okay.
All right. Mr. Corns' 15 is one that makes my number 14. So I'll discuss it here maybe in a second. But it's Rocky from 1976, directed by John Avildsen. The underdog story, Rocky didn't necessarily mark the starting point of this idea, but it's one that most point to as a shining example of how it can be done well on screen. The through line of most sports films, even to this day, runs directly through Rocky. I have also always loved the idea that, in the end, Rocky didn't win the cinematic battle against Apollo Creed. Oftentimes in sports, things are bigger than just the final result, and that's a lesson to have to remind myself as a diehard fan of several sports teams and figures.
I have it higher.
Okay, so that was my number 15, but we'll discuss it when we get to yours. You've already given your number 14.
Yep.
So that would move us to Mr. Corns' 14. He has down Chinatown, directed by Roman Polanski. When people throw around the word noir, Chinatown is the first film that comes to my mind, and it's probably that way for a lot of people. It's a diabolical, disturbing story about the seedy underbelly of a city, filmed exceptionally by Roman Polanski, and featuring one of the top on-screen pairs of the decade in Jack Nicholson and Faye Dunaway. All right, so that would move me to number 13 on my list. I have a movie we are set to rediscuss in some regard next week when we have a tiebreaker episode. I have American Graffiti.
Okay.
Not on your list?
It is not.
Okay, so I will discuss it here. 1973, George Lucas's second feature film, and really the one that allowed him the opportunity to do Star Wars, not only from a commercial success standpoint, but also to get the funding to do Star Wars, which I believe will be appearing later on both of our lists. Obviously, very influential in just being able to get the budgeting for Star Wars off the ground, which in itself is an accomplishment. But I think it's a symbol of the decade. Every decade seems to have their entry into the high school angst movie, and this seemed to be the one for this era. Dazed and Confused comes to mind. Superbad comes to mind. These movies somewhat are translatable across time. And this movie feels somewhat timeless, even though it's a period piece done in the 70s about a bunch of teens in the 50s. And I very much enjoy this movie for a lot of the young actors that are a part of it, notably Ron Howard, as well as Richard Dreyfuss and a very young Harrison Ford before his work in Star Wars and eventually Raiders of the Lost Ark. So that is my number 13. What is your number 13?
I have Apocalypse Now.
Okay, I have that much higher. And let's just check in with Mr. Corns. I believe he has it on his list. Yes, he also has it several places higher. So we will hold off on our discussion for that until a little bit later. All right, his number 13 is one I think will be appearing on both of our lists later, but it's All the President's Men, directed by Alan J. Pakula. I'll always be a sucker for a good film on the power of investigative journalism. There will probably never be a film in that subgenre that can top this, though, for me. Hoffman and Redford are electric together on screen, and in this age of large swaths of our population distrusting media, it's a reminder that there will, and always should be, a place in our society for the facts and truth to matter. That takes us to my number 12. I have The Sting, which you had in your honorable mentions, and I don't think it made Mr. Corns' list at all, either. I know that this is not necessarily one that's thought of as like a thought-provoking movie, or one that's highly influential, or one that's necessarily among the great Best Picture winners of all time. And I obviously have it outranking a few, since I don't have The Deer Hunter on my list at all. I obviously put Kramer versus Kramer, One Flew the Cuckoo's Nest, and The French Connection all in my honorable mentions. I just think it's a really well-done movie with two great performances by its leads, which I really wish they had had more films together than just the two that I'm well aware of. Redford and Newman are just fantastic together. They're two of the most affable stars that we probably ever produced out of this country as far as acting performances. And this is a vehicle for both of them to shine in something that's kind of just a fun caper movie. It doesn't necessarily have to be more than that. And sometimes it's just fun to have fun at the movies. With a wonderful, also villainous turn by Robert Shaw, The Sting from 1973, your Best Picture winner, is my number 12.
I love the film. I love the character actors, Harold Gould and Ray Walston. Wonderful in the film. Charles Durning is the crooked cop. Just wonderful film. I love it. I like to watch it at least once a year. It's comfort food. It's mac and cheese to me.
All right. You're number 12, sir.
MASH.
Ugh.
Robert Altman.
Well, you can tell I don't have this on my list.
Well, it spoke to me as a generation. Again, it was completely unusual, completely new and fresh, because it just told stories as hijinks. And it did it in a non-linear fashion that really kind of set a tone for comedy and comedy film in that time frame. Elliot Gould, Donald Sutherland, John Schalk, Gary Berghoff was in the film, as well as he's the only one to make the transition then to the TV show. I'm trying to remember, Sally Kellerman played Hot Lips. Robert Duvall was Frank Burns. I just love the film. I can watch it. It's not as funny now as it was at the time because it was completely fresh and original. And I think it's by far Robert Altman's best film.
Despite my difficulties with Robert Altman films, and this one in particular, I have to give it credit on a legacy front, which I know we're going to discuss this early next year or next season. Not only creating the TV show, but creating a permission structure for the workplace comedy to exist outside of stuffy offices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That really hadn't been done, and up until that point, I don't think another show like Cheers would have necessarily existed without the presence of MASH.
Good point. I guess I hadn't thought about it, but it does make sense.
All right, so Mr. Corns is number 12 here. We have a film that will appear later, at least on my list, and I think it might appear also on yours. We have Network from 1976, directed by Sidney Lumet.
Yes.
Of all the films of the 1970s, Network might be the one that has frighteningly been the most relevant in the 21st century. It was a scathing satire on the television and media industry then, but over time our reality has begun to mirror the film in a way that Sidney Lumet couldn't have possibly predicted when making this film. All right, so that's his number 12, which takes us to my number 11. I have the first appearance of a Spielberg film on the list. I have Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Okay.
Do you have it higher or no?
I do not.
So then I am the only person to have this one on our list. And even though there will be a much higher Steven Spielberg movie between all three of us, I would imagine, I should mention that I think this is on par with a lot of the science fiction movies of this decade and often gets kind of overlooked compared to some of Spielberg's other greater classics. If this was in somebody else's just generic filmography, I think this would be placed much higher in the classics list. I think it's a wonderful film. Richard Dreyfuss is amazing in it again. I think the presence of how alien life might come to a planet and how it's voiced when they first come down. I think some of these things, while maybe forgotten among the litany of great science fiction films or alien arrival films, it's one that I think is influential towards all those that come after it, even if we don't necessarily give it the credit it deserves. So I have this film partially because this is the film that Steven Spielberg always wanted to do. I have 1977's Close Encounters of the Third Kind as my number 11. That brings us to your number 11.
I have Rocky.
Okay, so I think we skipped our discussion until this point. So go ahead.
Rocky is not a sports film. Rocky is the film of a struggle of individuals to overcome their circumstances and to find meaning and purpose and to achieve something that they never thought that they could achieve. And it's by sheer will and determination. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be number one or the best, but that given your circumstances, you took an opportunity and you excelled and you did the best you could. And even if you fall short, you've achieved more than what most people could even dream of achieving. It's kind of like, you know, shoot for the stars, because even if you miss, you're on the moon type of
deal. You got that backward. It's shoot for the moon, because if you miss, you'll be among the stars.
Okay. Anyway, I saw it on a button, I don't know, 45 years ago, whatever. So to me, that's why Rocky is such a great film. It's not the boxing. It's not Stallone's acting. It's the story of just an average guy who's given an opportunity and excels and takes that opportunity. And it's not just him, but it's everybody in that film is given a chance to succeed where they had not thought they could. Everybody from Mick, Burgess Meredith's character, to Paulie, Burt Young. I mean, it's just a phenomenal film, and it says a lot about determination and drive and taking chances on opportunities.
Unfortunately, I'm going to disagree with your characterization. And of course, we're going to get into a semantics argument. Go figure. But while this doesn't start out as a sports movie, and I think that's why it ends up winning Best Picture, because it's not able to be dismissed among the generic sports film types, it creates the archetype for what is a sports story. It is an underdog getting some level of redemption for his life, giving additional meaning to what happens in his life. And even if he doesn't win out in the end, the nature by which he accomplishes something, gives his life additional meaning, by itself is victorious. And thus, even though it doesn't necessarily start out that way, it creates this archetype by which underdog movies, translated through the notion of sports, has become a backbone for a subgenre of film for the last 40 years. Caddyshack is an underdog film. Major League is an underdog film. The Sandlot, Little Big League. Name any of the great sports movies. Miracle, which in itself was about a true story, but about the underdog American amateurs beating the mighty Russian team. All sports movies are seen through the lens of Rocky, and that's why it has to be included among the best 15, because of its legacy, contributing towards the influential nature of creating almost amongst itself a subgenre of film.
I'm gonna disagree with you, and this is how I'm going to do it. It is more in line with the following set of films: Coal Miner's Daughter, Walk the Line, and Ray. Three films about people who came from poor backgrounds, who had nothing, who rose because of their circumstances and their abilities to rise to a certain level of fame, notoriety, and success. I think Rocky is more in tune to those other three films than it is to Major League or Caddyshack or any of those films.
All right. So that takes us, you had that at number 11?
Yes.
Okay. So then we get to Mr. Corns' number 11. He has a film that will not appear on my list only because I have yet to see it. The Exorcist from 1973, directed by William Friedkin. A horror film actually being nominated for Best Picture at the Oscars. Yeah, The Exorcist really is that important as a genre piece. As a young boy who went to a Catholic private school and attended Mass 6 days a week, this film scared the living shit out of me when I first saw it at far too young of an age. Some of the makeup and visuals don't hold up that well 50 years later, but the thematic elements of the film and the human nature of the story have endured. So that is his number 11.
Here's a story I don't know if I've ever told you. My parents used to be in a card club, so we had this babysitter. And every time the babysitter would come, she would find where we would have some film. I watched Rosemary's Baby with her. I must have been about 6 or 7. And I watched The Exorcist with her. So must have been about 9 or 10, I think, at that time. I saw some really some freaky stuff that I shouldn't have been watching at that age.
I wonder what my mother would have said had a babysitter showed me The Exorcist or The Silence of the Lambs or Scream when they were babysitting me and I was about 7 or 8 years old.
I never told anybody.
No, you were better than me, my friend. I tell everybody.
Really? I know.
Whole nine yards?
Yeah, fuck you.
Well, that's a good spot. For our first break, we will be right back. Before we jump back into the episode, next week, for only the second time so far, we're bringing you a tiebreaker episode between two vastly different films, Goldfinger from 1964 and American Graffiti from 1973. You won't want to miss that one, so watch ahead of the show by searching the Real Good app to find where they're streaming for you. That's R-E-E-L-G-O-O-D. Dad, we left off at my number 10. So at number 10, I know what will be a controversial film because it is at least higher on one person's list, and I'm sure it's higher on yours, but I have Star Wars.
Ooh, really? Okay.
I know I'm out on a limb here, but
yes,
I'll have my reasoning a little bit later.
Yeah, because you think the sequels were better.
One in particular that aids to this, yes. But also I have some other contributions as to science fiction films that I think should be a little bit higher.
Okay, fine, whatever. My number 10 is Taxi Driver.
Okay, I have this much higher on my list.
I figured you would.
For Mr. Corns' number 10, he has a movie I have yet to see, but will be the Kickstarter of our season 6. He has Barry Lyndon from 1975, directed by Stanley Kubrick. Of the two Kubrick films released in the decade, this probably won't be the choice for most people, but I'm not most people. I believe Barry Lyndon to be Kubrick's finest film in a catalog filled of almost entirely masterpieces. Barry Lyndon is alongside Lawrence of Arabia as the best-looking film ever made, frame to frame. The cinematography and the way it was lit are the stuff of legend at this point. It also tells a narrative that is patient over the runtime, but constantly twists and turns, and keeps me invested when I go back to it, annually at this point in my life. All right, so that was Mr. Corns' number 10. All right, so that leads me to my number 9. I have what I figure to be one of the best science fiction films ever made. I have Alien.
Okay.
Do you have it higher?
I do not even have it on my list.
Wow, not even on the list.
Nope.
And I know Mr. Corns has it a little bit higher, but I'll discuss it here. Ridley Scott's 1979 science fiction horror film. It is one we've discussed on the show on kind of multiple occasions because we also did the sequel. And you can go back to our first season if you want to listen to that episode. But in a time when we had Star Trek and Star Wars, this kind of broke the mold as to what space stories and science fiction stories could be told. And given that we'd had Close Encounters of Kind aliens before this, and we'd had Star Wars where aliens were mixed in with humans, to get something that created a genre to itself and then was subsequently parodied off of or was subsequently sequelized in a universe that has also created a franchise, I think this is a worthy entry here at number 9.
Okay.
Also with one of the more memorable individual scenes of the decade.
I would agree with that.
So what is your number 9 then, sir?
The Godfather Part 2.
Interesting. So I have this higher. Mr. Corns also has it higher. So okay. We'll wait on that discussion. All right. For his number 9 was your number 10, Taxi Driver 1976, directed by Martin Scorsese. New York City has never looked so gritty and grimy. Martin Scorsese captured the essence of 1970s New York due to his own experiences living there his entire life. He and Robert De Niro crafted a character, Travis Bickle, that is equal parts sympathetic and villainous. Is he an anti-hero or just the bad guy? Having the audience view the film through the lens of such a morally gray character was revolutionary for the time. So that takes us to my number 8, Blazing Saddles. I assume you have this higher?
Oh, yes.
Okay, so we'll hold there. So what is your number 8 then?
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
All right, so I kind of provided this in my honorable mentions, but you included here really rather high, and I know Mr. Corns has it on his list a little bit later, but why is it your number 8?
Well, the story itself I had trouble with, and I never really enjoyed it that much, but the acting performances were so phenomenal that I went back and forth. I had it higher. I had it lower. I had it off the list. I went back through. I thought about it, and I kind of compromised and put it at 8th, which is kind of like in the middle, because I just had a hard time with the film itself being such a difficult subject matter and such. But the acting performances of Louise Fletcher and Jack Nicholson were so phenomenal. Even the sub parts or the sub characters like Danny DeVito being in it were phenomenal. And so I just felt I had to put it in that ranking because it was something that was not only well done quality film, it was something that the Academy loved.
Well, and I think it's notable that it is one of only 3 winners of the Big 5 awards in a year where we've recognized that all 5 films are outstanding and have been celebrated across time. So to like it that much in its moment, it probably deserved to be higher on my list, but I think there are other films that have leapfrogged it since its original moment in the sun. All right, so we get to Mr. Corns' number 8. He has a film that will be appearing later on my list, and I think maybe appearing on yours. I think that's a pretty strong guess, but he has Jaws, 1975, directed by Steven Spielberg. The movie that put Steven Spielberg on the map and also probably caused millions of people to be afraid of going into the ocean after seeing it. Out of necessity, Spielberg had to show less of the shark than he originally intended, but fortunately it all worked out for the best. The less you see, the more terrifying it can actually be. Jaws has a musical score everyone knows, has dialogue that's been quoted for decades, and features one of my favorite monologues in any film, thanks to the great Robert Shaw. So that is his number 8, which then takes us to my number 7. I have Network. Do you have that higher?
I do.
All right, so we will hold on that one as well. So what is your number 7?
Monty Python's The Holy Grail.
I do not have that one. and Mr. Corns does not either. So you are the lone person on that island, my friend.
Okay, so when I was in high school, I was on the student newspaper, and the editor of the high school newspaper was Evelyn McDonald. Evelyn's went on to have a very successful career writing books and on music and rock and roll and women in rock and roll. I believe she was a music editor for Vanity Fair for a while. But she and some of the other people in the newspaper staff kept talking about Monty Python. And I had no idea what this was. And I watched the first time and I'm like, what the fuck is this shit? And then I watched it again and I started to snicker and I started to laugh. And then I kept watching it and I got more and more. And it's now to the point where this film will set me laughing. It has done more for me as far as humor and finding humor. And I mean, it was the first film, I think, that I really was starting to quote lines. I would get together with a good friend, Uncle Andy, and he and I would quote these lines back and forth. And it is such a well-done film by a group of absolutely brilliant comedians and comedic writers. You know, I know that a lot of people love The Life of Brian, and I've seen The Life of Brian. I find The Life of Brian funny, but the Holy Grail to me is the Holy Grail.
What's your favorite color?
Blue. No, red.
All right. So that is your number 8. Yes?
7.
7. All right. So that we move on to Mr. Corns' number 7. Film I already recognized, but Alien from 1979, directed by Ridley Scott. Ridley Scott changed the horror game with Alien. He brilliantly built tension without needing to reveal too much of the monster early on, put a strong female protagonist in the lead role, and delivered one of the most shocking moments of the entire decade with the chest burster scene. They might not be able to hear you scream in space, but there was plenty of it to hear on Earth when audiences went to see this. All right, so that takes us to my number 6. I have All the President's Men. I would assume you have this higher.
I do.
All right, so I have to hold on this discussion as well. What is your number 6?
I have Network.
All right, so we get to our Network discussion here. Do you want to start the discussion on Network?
Every time I watch this film, I am so utterly disgusted as to how it wasn't satire, but prophetic. It is point on. In fact, I thought seriously about putting it in the top 3 simply because it is so, it so describes what's going on today. It has gotten to the point where network news and where the media is able to be a tool of propaganda to convince people of things that do not exist. The facts don't matter. The opinion does, and how it's presented. And so Network has more impact and provides more disclosure of what was happening and what was likely to happen than any film up to that point, and probably since.
I know this was originally created as satire, but it's become kind of a modern horror film because of how on the nose it seems to be. One of the more brilliantly crafted screenplays that I think has ever been created by Paddy Chayefsky. This movie is so ahead of its time that it is almost laughable by itself. This movie is to media what 1984 is to government.
Yes.
And I think it's one of the more important films of this particular decade. I think it actually ages a little bit better than All the President's Men, just personally, even though I have All the President's Men a little bit higher, just from some of the execution and other aspects of the film, and a little bit more of an enjoyability factor that I did somewhat include. I just think that this movie is outstanding, and probably, I mean, it's right up there with 12 Angry Men as Lumet's best.
Yes.
All right, so then that takes us to Mr. Corns' number 6. He has Apocalypse Now. 1979, directed by Francis Ford Coppola. War films have never been the same. Coppola's Vietnam War Odyssey nearly drove everyone who made it insane, including the director, and that's evident in the final product, regardless of which cut you watch. Filled with memorable quotes, iconic imagery, and a soundtrack of music that encapsulated the time. All right, so that takes us to our second commercial break, and we'll be right back. Before we jump back into the episode, and before we get to the Stanley Rubric in a minute, if you're ever curious about our Master Greatest Movies of All Time list that has every graded movie we've ever discussed on the show, there's a link in the episode description of every episode of this show, or you can go to RonnieDuncanStudios.com and find it as the top entry on the Greatest Movie of All Time podcast show page. That has the grades we've done so far for all 191 movies we've graded, and we continue to add more each week. Make sure to check that out as we go and follow along. Also, if you're curious in capacity for this particular episode, what were our top 1970s movies so far on the Greatest Movie of All Time list, here are the top 18, as we've only discussed 18 from this decade, and we have a long way yet to go. Number 18, A Bridge Too Far. Number 17, Slapshot. Number 16, Rocky II. 15, Superman the Movie. 14, Monty Python and the Holy Grail. 13, Rocky. 12, The Sting. 11, American Graffiti. 10, Network. 9, Alien. 8, Young Frankenstein. 7, Blazing Saddles. 6, Apocalypse Now. 5, Taxi Driver. 4, The Godfather Part 2. 3, All the President's Men. 2, The Godfather. And number 1, Jaws. And again, that is from our master list of the greatest movies of all time, which measures something different than the best movies of all time, which is what we're trying to do tonight. So, before we jump back into the rest of the fun, Dad, do we have anyone to remember this week?
Yes. Barbara Rush, 97, American actress. It Came from Outer Space, Peyton Place, and All My Children. Jerry Conway, 76, English drummer and percussionist, was in the band Jethro Tull, Fairport Convention, and was with Cat Stevens. Barbara Baldwin, 85, American actress and casting member.
She was in the show Medical Center as an actress, and she also worked on the shows Trapper John, MD, and Dynasty for casting.
Joe Flaherty, 82, American actor and writer. Was in the film Happy Gilmore, was in the TV show SCTV, Second City TV, Freaks and Geeks, and was in Back to the Future Part 2. And Louis Gossett Jr., 87, American actor, An Officer and a Gentleman, Roots, Iron Eagle, won the Oscar in 1982 for An Officer and a Gentleman and an Emmy for Roots.
And he was also only the second Black male actor to win an Academy Award. And so we remember these here fondly for their contributions with a moment of silence here in their honor. Thank you. Back to our regularly scheduled programming, we have my number 5. I have Apocalypse Now. So I can start the discussion on this one.
Sure.
I think that it's summed up a lot better in our revisit episode from a few months ago, but this one started to really click with me the last time that we had it on. And even though this isn't technically the first Vietnam film, it's certainly not the first psychedelic film that had been released. It combines a lot of elements of what people were feeling about the Vietnam War and packaged it into a time in which this was still very fresh for most people at the time, in a way that I think Platoon was a little bit more removed, became a little bit more objective about what had happened in the Vietnam War, as opposed to this, which was, while fictionalized, speaking to a specific era of culture that I think is not always as translatable as we'd like it to believe. I highly respect the film. I think that you get a great performance by several great characters in this film. I think it's highly iconic. It's definitely influential, and I think my appreciation for it when we last discussed it grew exponentially, and that's why it's this high on the list for me.
I like the film tremendously. I think Robert Duvall's character is phenomenal. Martin Sheen is wonderful. It just doesn't resonate with me as much, but I'm on that cusp. I'm in that weird period where I'm part of the last portion of the baby boom, but my memory of the Vietnam War was primarily us, you know, bringing the troops out and the returning of the POWs. So I don't have as strong a relationship with it, and I don't necessarily understand exactly the whole concept of every aspect of it that took, you know, I mean, there's certain parts of this that I kind of scratch my head about and don't grasp. So that's what's keeping, or what knocked me down to 13. Do I understand that this is a great achievement? You know, I just got done, I think earlier today, watching a video or watching an interview that Coppola did about filming Apocalypse Now. And he made the comment that he had no idea how to film this. He had no idea how to go about doing it. He said most of the time filmmaking is kind of the concept of running down a railroad track with an engine bearing down at you. But I think realistically, some of the great achievements in the world are by people who didn't know what they were doing and just did it because they did not have to follow convention. So I give great applause to Coppola for achieving this film without, by his own admission, knowing how to do it.
I would say a great many of the greatest mistakes are also made by people not knowing what they're doing and doing it anyway.
Yes, I know.
So that takes us to your number five.
All the President's Men.
You may lead.
This film, to me, is always a great piece of cinema. It is a story that I followed. I remember as a kid, yes, I was a kid who sat and watched the Watergate hearings over the summer of 1973 and 74. And was enthralled by these powerful men debating issues of corruption and power run amok, and was fascinated by it at a very early age. And so when I remember reading the book while I was in junior high, and I didn't see the film until it was out on, I want to say, HBO in the late 70s. So I did not see it. I read the book probably a good 4 or 5 years before I saw the film. But the film has always had a profound impact on me. The performances, even the sub-performances, Hal Holbrook, Jason Robards, just phenomenal. And I just think it's so well done and such a great capture of what was going on in that period that it deserves such a high ranking, and at least on my list.
So I had it at number seven, and excuse me, I had it at number six, so not all that different from you. But I think that this movie is not only important because it raised an entire, well, I would say multiple generations of potential journalists on the lessons of Watergate. And not to trust anybody, to dig underneath stories, don't necessarily believe everything at first glance. But I think it's also negatively affected our journalism at this point, thinking that there's mudraking at every turn, that everybody's constantly lying. And I think it's still highly influential, if not only just for that. But this is the third in the Paranoia trilogy by Pakula of this decade. I think this is highly stylized. It takes what's arguably some very dry material, while fascinatingly due to the scandal level that it was at the time and some of the nature of the scandalous effect that's attached to it. I still think a lot of this and what Watergate was built on was accounting. So this movie somehow takes accounting and journalism about accounting and makes it entertaining and palatable for the masses, which is an extraordinary accomplishment by itself. I think it is the quintessential journalism movie, but because of that, again, I think it has some destructive tendencies even moving forward, and yet we wouldn't get great journalism without this kind of movie basically creating folk heroes out of Woodward and Bernstein, and by extension, Hoffman and Redford. So I think it is an exceptional movie. I think it is a highly entertaining movie. This is one that I could probably sit down and watch at just about any point and have no problems with it whatsoever, but it is at my number 6. So, all right, that takes us to Mr. Corns' number 5. He has The Godfather, directed by Francis Ford Coppola. What more can actually be said about The Godfather at this point, especially since we had an episode about it last week? It's been mansplained to death over the years. It's cinematic perfection. It effectively acts as a bridge between Hollywood eras, with Marlon Brando and Al Pacino front and center acting their asses off. So my number 4 then, I have The Godfather Part 2. You had already discussed this one, but
yes,
maybe one of the seminal acting performances of all time with Pacino as Michael in Part 2. As good as I think he is in Part 1, he goes up by a good margin in Part 2. I think it is a great character study of power and how it not only corrupts everything that you touch and everybody around you, but your soul internally. I think it's much more Shakespearean than the original Godfather, which I find to be much more enjoyable. I consider this a very great movie. It's not as much of an entertaining watch for me because it is as dark and dense as you would think it is. I think it's the much richer tapestry to explore if you're a film fan. It's not nearly as quotable in some senses in my mind as the original Godfather. I don't think it has quite the highs for me individually as a film fan, but I find it here at number 4 specifically because I have just a few things that I thought excelled a little bit higher, but I could see how anybody could have this above The Godfather if they just like the density, the richness of this a little bit more, the character study a little bit more than the original Godfather. I don't tend to agree, but that's where I have it right now. And you had it at number 9.
Yes. So, I mean, I can appreciate the performances. I thought the story was not as compelling as Godfather Part 1. Yes, of course, it's a great film. It's probably the greatest sequel ever made, but it just doesn't rank. It doesn't touch me and rank as high to me as it does to some, I guess. I don't know. It just never really connected with me. Now, I haven't watched it again in a while. And as we said last week, Godfather Part 1 became much more clear to me and understandable as to what it was and its impact. Maybe if I watched Part 2 again, it would be better. It's been a while since I'd seen it. But based on that, it deserves to be in the top 15, which it is on my list. I just don't feel it deserved to be ranked higher than where I had it, for obviously, I guess.
All right. So then we're up to your number 4.
Number 4, Blazing Saddles. I understand how cringy sometimes the language is and the comedy involved, but Blazing Saddles did this to a whole generation, I think actually 3 generations, to show that comedy could be social commentary even more than it ever had been. And the fact that I think it did more to skewer racism in this country than anything else that had come up to that point in time. Just the sheer stupidity of some of the comments. It did such a phenomenal job of opening up people's concepts or ideas as to the stupidity of racism that I think it deserves to be in the upper echelons of the decade for its impact.
I think it is Mel Brooks's finest film. I think that you have great charismatic leads in Cleavon Little and Gene Wilder. You have quotable lines all over the place. And I know that it may not be for everybody's taste. It is for ours personally. And a lot of the lines are not repeatable in polite society, especially in a uber sensitive, politically correct nature that we're in now. But this movie is as funny as it is because it can get away with the things that it did at its time. And it's lampooning an entire genre of film while still making a notable social commentary of its moment. And there are not many films that are able to connect and hit all of those points simultaneously. While I had it at my number 8, it's certainly worthy of being potentially higher. All right, we move to Mr. Corns' number 4. He has a film that will not appear on my list because I have yet to see it. Halloween from 1978, directed by John Carpenter. The slasher, the scream queen, the birth of a horror monster icon that has struck fear into the hearts of many of a horror film lover, John Carpenter's Halloween is the gold standard of 70s horror. It's a lean, mean killing machine.
It's been a long time since I've seen it.
Okay, so then we move to my number 3, which for a long period of time was our number 1 on the greatest movie of all time list. But I have Jaws.
Okay.
You have yet to have it on your list. You've said that you have it on your list. So is this also your number 3 or is it higher?
It's higher.
All right, so we will hold on that discussion for now. So what is your number 3?
The Godfather Part 1.
I have it higher.
Yeah. So we can hold on that, I guess.
All right, so we go to Mr. Corns' number 3. He has a film you've already mentioned, but One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, 1975, directed by Milos Forman. This is the third film from 1975 to appear on my list, which is why that year was in my top 10 individual years on the previous G-Mote episode in January. I think it's Nicholson's best performance as an actor, has an all-time villain in Nurse Ratched, and has an ensemble cast of young actors, many of which went on to great things over their careers. It's also one of the rare films that I believe exceeds the quality of the novel it is based on. All right, so we move to my number 2. I have Taxi Driver. I think this is Martin Scorsese's finest film. I think it is a film that, despite being made in the 70s, could be talking about a lot of things that are going on today. It is a out-of-touch, isolated young man following a political campaign. If that doesn't say 2024, I don't know what does. And he thinks of himself as this marauding hero that is the last bastion of what is good about America, somehow. I don't know how this movie is made almost 50 years ago, and is this prophetic, able to get inside the mind of somebody that I clearly don't understand, yet can appreciate. The horrific nature of this film, including its bloody consequences in the ending, leave me just floored yet to as of now. And I know that you don't necessarily agree. We had a large discussion on it last year when we revisited this one. And I think we had a similarly good discussion on it in our original episode in season 1. But I think this is an exceptional film by an exceptional filmmaker. And that's why it is my number 2.
It deserves to be on the list. I just don't find that it has the same impact to me as it does to you. I think it glorifies some bizarre behavior, and I can name a couple of different people that are running around in society right now who are modern versions of Travis Bickle, and I don't want to glorify them.
See, I just don't get the sense this is glorifying, but rather trying to humanize and maybe empathize with those sorts of people that are lost and trying to give us a insight into their psyche a little bit, even if we don't like what we see.
Okay. I'll take your point, but I just don't appreciate it to the same level you do.
So that was your number 10. What is your number 2?
Star Wars. Star Wars to me, I mean, I remember going and seeing it at the theater, was amazed by it. It changed how films were perceived. The whole idea of CGI and of all of that changed with this film. It presented a futuristic concept of good, evil, right, wrong, all of that. It just was such a game changer, especially when you grew up in that period. And this would have been out while I believe I was a freshman in high school, maybe eighth grade, actually. In between my eighth and ninth grade years. It just had such an impact, and it's such a beautifully done film for its time. Yeah, in retrospect, you know, the graphics, the special effects are not as good, but for this, there wouldn't be the level of special effects that we have now.
I think that this film is incredibly influential. I think that's somewhat of even an understatement in that. I think this movie, it was able to accomplish taking science fiction and taking it from what was a maybe minority special interest niche and making this mainstream. It gave room for nerds to come out and celebrate their nerddom for maybe one of the first times. Gave an entire new class of people something to cheer and look forward to and root for. It has made defining and lasting characters out of almost its entire cast and almost all of the actors that were included in this just by their sheer inclusion in the film. It is a highly stylized film. I think it is by far Lucas's best film, at least that he directed, if not, because obviously he's created other ones that I think a little bit more highly of. I just put it at 10 because I think there were a little bit better science fiction films in this era, one, and that we had a lot of space science fiction films being made right at this point in time. So I give it a little bit of an undercut there as far as best. I don't think it holds up as well, partially because of what's come after it in that particular franchise and what has been birthed beyond it. I also think it pales in comparison to its sequel as far as concept. And maybe this is just me picking on the film a little bit because it's been with me so much, but it has become a little bit formulaic. It is borrowing another storyline from a much more celebrated filmmaker, in my opinion, and kind of just overlays space on top of what at that time was medieval Japan. Or feudal Japan, I suppose. So while I think it is an important movie, it is a loved movie, it's probably the most beloved movie of the 1970s. I just can't put in a list where we're ranking the best movies above some of the other ones that I had. All right, so that takes us to Mr. Corns' number two, a film that we just discussed, but The Godfather Part II from 1974, directed by Francis Ford Coppola. You're either a part one or a part two kind of person when it comes to The Godfather. And if by some chance you're a part three person, well, you'd be the first. Obviously, The Godfather was already on my list at number five, but I think Coppola's sequel reaches a greater height than the original. It set the bar for what a sequel could and should be, and Robert De Niro's performance as a young Vito Corleone is on the Mount Rushmore of my favorite acting roles in the history of cinema. I love it that much. All right, so we get to what we've all been waiting for, and if you've been counting down, you're pretty well aware of what my number one will be. But I have The Godfather Part One. I know it's probably cliche for me. It might be my favorite film of this entire decade. I think it is cinematic masterpiece at its finest. I could watch the thing over and over and over again. And while I have many films from this decade that I love to watch over and over and over again, Jaws, Star Wars, All the President's Men, this is one that I've probably watched over and over. And I seem to always grasp something new to appreciate about it every time that I watch it. And so for me, not only is it one of the rare examples where we had an overlap between the critics and the average film-going crowd, as we did several times during this decade, notably Star Wars and Jaws. But I also think that this is also one of the few times that even on second, third, fourth, fifth glances, the lists of the greatest films of all time, this by far is the highest of any of these, let's say, popular films of this era. While Jaws and Star Wars are held up by critics in some circles, I don't think they quite reach the heights of The Godfather. And it's because, to me, it's just a little bit different of a film. It has the Shakespearean nature. It's a family drama. It's about power. It's about corruption. It's about society and history of America in the 20th century. I think it has so much going on for it. And it is probably one of the most often quoted movies when you're talking about business that I think there is. So for me, The Godfather is my number one, is the best film of the 1970s. All right, Dad, I think I know at this point what your number one is, but
Jaws. Every time I see it, I just can't believe how perfect a movie it really is. And I know Andrew talked about it. The monologue by Robert Shaw is phenomenal. There's nothing about the film that I can find a major flaw in, or even a minor, well, there are a few minor flaws, but nothing of significance. It's, to me, a film that defined an entire generation of filmmaking. And it's just perfect to me as well as films could be at that time.
If you are of the crowd that thinks this is a horror film, I would present that this is probably the most popular and mass appealing horror film of all time. Because yes, there are plenty of people that do not count themselves as horror fans or horror lovers that love Jaws. The fact that this thing is made at all is shocking in itself when you know any of the history of how this thing came about. The amount of just sheer accidents that came together in order to create this film is mind-boggling. And yet somehow all of these things serve to create one of the cinematic masterpieces by probably the greatest living director we have, and helps create or establish his career and the careers of so many others that worked on these films. I sit in awe every time that we've had to discuss it, and it gets better with each viewing, each discussion, each time that it comes up for me. I totally understand why it's your number one. I had it slightly at number three, just because I think the other two movies are a little bit more stylized and are a little bit, I don't even want to say better, because it's like choosing between your children a little bit. The fact that it took me until a few years ago when we discussed it on the show to watch this film, because I was just kind of like at arm's length thinking this would be somewhat terrifying. And I find it to be an engaging romp every time through it. Mm-hmm. And there's so much still to grasp out of it, out of the movie, that it's hard to fathom why it would be outside of most people's top 15 of this era, let alone, you know, it's comfortably inside each of our top threes. All right, so we get to our last inclusion, the number one film by Mr. Andrew Corns. And while this is obvious to some, Star Wars from 1977, directed by George Lucas, is his number one film of the 1970s. Star Wars changed the game, plain and simple. It was a cultural phenomenon, the likes of which I don't think had been seen before. Sure, Kubrick had already shown how great science fiction could be done in the 60s with 2001: A Space Odyssey, but George Lucas was able to craft something in outer space that appealed to a much wider audience. The Star Wars brand is still one of the most popular and lucrative properties in the entire media landscape, and it's all owed to how great the original film was. And I think that I heard this morning that in the most recent rankings of highest net worth filmmakers of all time, George Lucas is easily number one.
Yes.
All right, just a recap of our lists here. I had number 15, Dirty Harry, 14, Rocky, 13, American Graffiti, 12, The Sting, 11, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, 10, Star Wars, 9, Alien, 8, Blazing Saddles, 7, Network, 6, All the President's Men, 5, Apocalypse Now, The Godfather Part 2 at number 4, 3, Jaws, 2, Taxi Driver, and number 1, The Godfather. Your list was?
15, The Deer Hunter, 14, Dirty Harry. 13, Apocalypse Now. 12, MASH. 11, Rocky. 10, Taxi Driver. 9, The Godfather Part 2. 8, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. 7, Monty Python's The Holy Grail. 6, Network. 5, All the President's Men. 4, Blazing Saddles. 3, The Godfather Part 1. 2, Star Wars. And 1, Jaws.
And Mr. Corns' list, 15, Rocky. 14, Chinatown. 13, All the President's Men. 12, Network. 11, The Exorcist. 10, Barry Lyndon. 9, Taxi Driver. 8, Jaws. 7, Alien. 6, Apocalypse Now. 5, The Godfather. 4, Halloween. 3, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. 2, The Godfather Part 2. And number 1, Star Wars. All right, so those are our top 15s for each of us. If you have a different top 15, top 5, top 1, you can certainly write to us if you think we got it wrong and argue for your favorite film by finding us at Gmote Podcast on any of our socials. That will include YouTube, Letterboxd, X, Instagram, or Facebook. You can also find us at our email, greatestalltimemoviepodcast@gmail.com. But before we go tonight, we have a couple more Ask Dana Anything questions, or ADAs.
Okay.
All right, so let's see here. You wanted me to work my way in. Least obnoxious.
Okay.
Brat or burger?
Ooh. Do I have control over the condiments?
I would assume so, yes.
Probably burger. Although I could split it, which is take a brat and split it down the middle, lay it on top of the burger. That is awesome. But burger, because... And that raises the question of, is bacon a condiment?
As you know, I think so. But it raises one of our great barroom debates of all time when I asked and made the argument that bacon was a condiment.
For a burger, it is.
I think it's just a condiment, period. But your opinion may differ. And if you think I'm wrong, as most people seem to think I am, you can write us at any of our social media at Gmote Podcast, or at greatestalltimemoviepodcast@gmail.com, or find us on the website. Any of those will do. You can harass me via any of those.
Feel free. It's a good time.
All right. Does Dana think he has the skills to win a hypothetical court case if he was pitted against Vincent Gambini?
Of course. I don't even need to think about it. Of course. I might be a little rusty at this point in time, but I think at one point in time, I had the court skills to beat about anybody.
Ooh, those are some, you saying you were Johnny Cochran back in the day?
I think I could have beat Johnny Cochran in the day.
Boy, that's a bold statement.
Oh yeah. You didn't get to see me walk. You know, I had an ability to connect with jurors. I could read a jury and figure out pretty clearly whether I had a more sophisticated jury or a less sophisticated jury, and I could connect, and I knew how. And I knew how to go about it, how what to say, how to present myself, and how to do it. There's a reason why I had 150 jury trials, and I won a lot more than I lost, and I did criminal defense work.
First of all, I did see you actually in action. I saw you over the course of 2 different trials. Part of it is as though I don't remember any of that. And 2, I didn't know what was going on because I was probably like 7 or 8.
Yeah, okay.
It'd be very different than if I watched one of them today. That being said, for anybody that missed the reference, Vincent Gambini is the fictional character played by Joe Pesci in the film My Cousin Vinny.
I know. And quite frankly, there's a lot of how he did things that I did. So... in other words, your grits can be cooked at a different pace, or, you know, I did shit like that all the time. And I would pride myself if I could get Chortles out of the jury. And I did.
Well, I think you play well to a Wisconsin crowd, but I would find it very difficult to believe that you could have beaten Johnny Cochran during the OJ trial. With a mostly black inner city LA jury. Boy.
Am I prosecuting it?
That's a good question. I don't know if Johnny could have done the same work if he were the prosecutor either.
And so could I have done enough to, could I have done as well or better than Johnny did and get OJ acquitted? I think I could have.
All I can say is I would have really liked to have seen your cross-examination of Mark Furman.
Yeah, because, I mean, you're aware of it. You've seen it. You've seen it in late context.
Well, in situations that matter a lot less, and when you're dealing with people like my little sister who are not used to being trained against somebody who's cross-examining them.
Or state representatives. No, let me put it this way. My cross-examinations have always been really good. I don't know where I figured it out, but I've had a talent for cross-examination. And I can make people look really foolish.
It's kind of both a benefit to your practice and also a downside that now it's really only trained on vocational experts.
that doesn't even take any prep. I can do that in my sleep.
Well, that's just from multiple decades trying to do it. I would say that most people have transferable skills and experience after a couple of decades doing any job.
I'll agree.
So that is our Ask Dana Anything for the week. And again, if you want to submit any questions, anything really obnoxious you would like Dana to answer on air, you can, again, submit questions via our website, RonnieDuncanStudios.com/GMotePodcast, or email, greatestmovieofalltimepodcast@gmail.com, or via any of our social handles at GMote Podcast on TikTok, Instagram, Letterboxd, YouTube, or I guess it's X, the site formerly known as Twitter.
Well, just a second. I mean, when you're talking about obnoxious, I mean, I'll just like, you know, don't ask this stupid because the question or the answer is boxers. So, okay.
So that's going to do it for us this week. Thank you for listening. I'll take my milkshakes, shaken, not stirred. Next week, for only the second time so far, we're bringing you a tiebreaker episode between two vastly different films, Goldfinger from 1964 and American Graffiti from 1973. You won't want to miss that one, so watch ahead of the show by searching the Real Good app to find where they're streaming for you. That's R-E-E-L-G-O-O-D. Please like, follow, rate, and review, or whatever on whichever platform you have so that more can join in our fun. You can also email the show at thenewRodneyDuncanStudios.com or at greatestalltimemoviepodcast@gmail.com or find us on YouTube, Instagram, X, Letterboxd, or TikTok at the handle at GMote Podcast. The Greatest Movie of All Time is a production of Ronnie Duncan Studios. Our show is mixed, edited, and written by Thomas Duncan. Our music is thanks to Purple Planet Music. Our technical provider and distributor is Captivate FM.